Welcome, everyone, to the January 10th, 2011 Podomatic podcast of the A Word. I am one of your hosts, the lovely Glenn Watson, also known as All Babies Are Atheist on YouTube.
And I am the always evil yet amazingly stunningly attractive Kate Farr, also known as Bionic Dance on YouTube.
Well, one of those facts is correct. I'll let everyone out there figure out which one.
It's the part where I'm evil, I'm telling ya.
Folks, she's just said that she's ugly and evil, so I'll leave that in her incapable hands. There's no way to win out of that one.
It's well, like, I could just be plain.
It's like saying, do you beat your girlfriend in the closet? There's no winning on that one either.
In any event, we are here to discuss atheism and skepticism and issues surrounding them. What have we got today, Glenn?
Oh, we've got a couple of things. Firstly, we've had ourselves, now this will be, I guess, our sixth podcast.
And, something like that?
Yeah. And one of the things I'm planning to do, it'll be to be announced on the aword.podomatic.com site, is to place a compilation monthly, starting with December, of our The A Word podcasts and make it available on iTunes as a 99-cent purchase, which normally you don't pay anything for these. I think that it's not too much once we set up a nice little, it's sort of a best of monthly. And perhaps, if we're still around in 12 months, we'll have sort of a year in review that will be available at a slightly higher cost. One-stop
it's
shopping.
It's certainly going to be worth it, if only just to listen to our amazing selves. By the way, I'm also extraordinarily modest and humble. So, regardless, though, we'd like to think that we discuss issues that are relevant and important to people. Hopefully, we make you think about things in ways you never thought about them before, give you some new information, and just generally make life a little more interesting and a little easier to cope with.
One would hope. And definitely, one of the places that we get most of our ideas for Kate and myself, and it's a place that we invite all of you, one and all, is on a regular basis, we have a blog TV broadcast. And a blog TV, for anyone who's not aware, it's sort of like a radio program with pictures, sort of a television on the internet site. I will make the site available for mine and for Kate's, available on our Podomatic podcast once we're done here. But what we do is we spend a lot of time with people who ask us questions, we debate things, we talk over and just generally rant. Here's a couple of the things that we've been talking about.
Indeed. Well, one of the things we have been talking about lately is atheist morality, where we get our morals and how. There are religious people out there who insist that morals have to be handed down by God. Atheists, not having a God, are clearly immoral, according to them, which, let's face it, is completely not true.
Or by true definition, at least basically amoral, which of course means just an absence of morality. I don't know how they think then we make our judgment calls if we have absolutely no morality whatsoever. I think possibly, especially the fundamentalists or the young earth creationists, they definitely go towards the immoral, which is basically would be someone who has either very bad morals or is someone who would be, I guess, in a Dungeons and Dragons game, would be chaotic evil.
Well, the thing is that these people, they think that there has to be some kind of objective standard that is not subject to human opinion against which to judge your actions. And most of them hold up their holy book to say, this is it. Now, frankly, I find a lot of what's in that holy book to be completely immoral. Mind you, which things I find immoral depend on which holy book. But the point is that it's pretty clear morality is a matter of opinion, a matter of perspective. Everybody does not agree on what is or is not moral. And so you can't say that just because morals were handed down by God, well, what if we don't agree with God? Just because a deity, if one even exists, hands down a set of rules, well, why should we trust what that deity has to say? I know a lot of religious people right now, they hear that and they don't understand how you can say that, because to them, it's just a matter of extreme truth that God says it, therefore it's so. But I don't see how that can possibly be. I mean, do we obey our parents all the time? Do we agree with our parents all the time? And if God is the celestial parent figure, well, aren't we allowed to grow up and disagree with God too?
Not according to them.
They'd say no, but I don't see them justifying that. They seem to take it for granted so much that none of them have ever been able to explain it to me.
Well, not only is his word supposed to be infallible, they actually call him the Word. Basically, he is. He is the creator of the universe, and not only that, he is the only thing in the universe that is perfect. And I think one good look over his book that's supposedly inspired by him, capital H him, would be one way to say I beg to differ.
Well, if they're going to call God the Word, then let me just say, word to your mother.
Very good.
You know, sometimes I'm on a roll. Other times I'm on a bagel. Watch out for the hole.
I'm not even going to ask about the cream cheese. I'm not going to ask about the lox and cream cheese. I am
in
not.
In any event, though, I mean, atheist morality, where do atheists get our morals from? I mean, if not from God, then where? Because, I mean, I have my own personal answer, but what about you, Glenn?
I think it's when we send in the box tops off of our Cocoa Krispies.
Okay, serious answer. Imagine I have to be the one to come up with the serious answer today. But as far as I'm concerned, morality is the intersection of harmful versus beneficial and with permission versus without permission. Which is to say that if you were to plot a point on a graph where you do an action to somebody and you have their permission to do that action, then it really doesn't matter, as far as I'm concerned, whether it hurts or benefits, because you had permission to do it. Doing things against other people's will tends to be immoral. Mind you, there are times when doing something against someone's will because it's beneficial can be a good thing. You know, if someone refuses critical medical treatment or something, and you do it anyway to save their life, or maybe they've decided to kill themselves or something, and you pull them down off the bridge, well, you know, you did something against their will, but you did something beneficial. You know, maybe that was moral, maybe not. It's kind of a gray area. And if you do something with permission that's beneficial, that is clearly a good thing. But if you do something without permission that's harmful, well, that would be immoral. The problem is that everybody has a different scale. They plot for themselves like, well, this is something I never want done for me. This is something that I would consider not beneficial. Well, someone else might decide that's completely beneficial. They may love that and give permission to do it. So that's the thing, is that morality is, by nature, subjective. It's a matter of opinion. It's a matter of personal taste and perspective.
Well, I think it's in the where there's wiggle room or no wiggle room comes down to how people view laws, penal codes, things that are handed down by our government to us, whether it be municipal, provincial, or state and federal, and world laws now that we have the United Nations with their different codes. And some people look at them as you have to look at the heart of a law rather than the body of it. Some people go by the letter of the law, and they say that no matter what the law says, no matter how you feel about it, you have to obey it. And other people say, look, you have to look at each law and determine whether or not it's fair or not.
And you're talking about the letter versus the spirit, yes, basically.
Yes, the heart of the spirit, the intent behind the law. And so if someone, for example, we have laws against sexual predators. Now, they also unfortunately batch in people like some poor 17-year-old schmuck who gets too drunk with his friends, gets his ass bare and out of a window of his car and gets arrested for public indecency. Unfortunately, if you go by the letter of the law, now he is a sexual predator. He is a pervert under the letter of the law and therefore must be put on a predator list and be told anytime. People, when he goes into a neighborhood, have to be told. Anyone with children is going to be afraid of this person if they don't know the entire content of what happened.
Well, I don't know if your laws about sexual predators are different where you live, Glenn, but here, public nudity does not equal sexual predator. You pretty much have to be trying to harm somebody with sex to be a sexual predator, to force yourself upon them in certain ways. Mind you, I have heard of other laws that are very, very draconian, not necessarily dealing with sex, but some that do, where it's clear that people are being put on these lists that are not warranted to be there. So I do see what you're saying. I'm not sure that the specifics are accurate, at least to where I live.
Well, actually, I used it from the United States. There have been several cases where somebody, when in their youth, has either urinated in public or flashed somebody, like, you know, basically given them a full moon out of a car, and unfortunately, because it's considered a sexual crime of public nudity, You've exposed yourself to someone else. Now, these laws were intended, the spirit of the law was that if somebody in an overcoat goes into a neighborhood with kids, goes up to the kindergarten class outside on recess and flashes themselves in an overcoat, now this person has become a danger to society. Unfortunately, it's such a blanket law. It covers people who, when they're drunk and coming home from the bar, they take a whiz on some brick wall, or they've decided to have a little bit of after-school fun. So, and that's where the letter versus the spirit. Now, a policeman who understands the difference may see this kid stop the vehicle and say, you know what, I could arrest you for sticking your ass out of this window, but that would cause you irreparable damage in your adult life, so I'm going to let this slide, but if I ever see you again, I'll take a taser to you. You know, whatever he decides is going to be a good threat. Now, that would be somebody who takes a fair and balanced measure. It's the same with morality. If there was an external moral code that had absolutely was written in stone, it would definitely cause grief to a great number of people because, as we've seen, especially when you take the biblical morals, they don't fit anybody in the 21st century, hardly.
Well, in any event, it does seem as if this whole discussion about where morality comes from gets in the way when talking with religious people all the time. Some of them have even gone so far as to say weird things like, well, if God wasn't around, then I would just be free to go killing and maiming and murdering and robbing and all of this stuff. You know, and the only reason I don't is because God's there. I'm sitting there thinking, okay, well, I don't have a God like yours, and I'm not robbing everything. Where's the disconnect here? You know what? Why can't you be calm and rational and reasonable enough to not go around stealing and killing and doing all that horrible stuff just because you think there's a God up in the sky? That doesn't make a lick of sense.
No. Yeah, you've actually received messages on YouTube that way, haven't you, where people have basically said, if I didn't have God in my life, I would be a self-destructive maniac, to paraphrase.
I don't think I've gotten that many, but I've certainly spoken to other people who have.
Right. Well, you know, and the thing is you'll also, as we know, that a lot of people, especially Christians, like to wiggle around anything if you try to fix them in this particular way and say, look, we don't have a God, and so how do you explain it now? What they'll often say is, well, God is secretly working in your life to try to get you back. And it's too bad.
They're always making excuses or coming up with ways that things that may or may not be God, they have to attribute to God. They love to come up with all of these different ways of not having to prove that it really is their deity,
right,
or even that their deity exists at all. They want their side to be right so badly that they'll make stuff up or avoid acknowledging contradictory facts, all kinds of things. It's just, it's impossible to talk to that kind of person because they cannot accept the notion that they're not right about something. I mean, there have been so many things in my life that I have wanted to be true, but because the evidence was against me, I've had to abandon them. That's called playing by the rules, playing fair, accepting hard truths, accepting evidence. I'd rather know more true things than false things, frankly. Wouldn't you?
Yeah, and even more simply, it's just living in the real world. Eyes wide open. I mean, it's fine to want to wish things to be. And a matter of fact, when it comes to things like laws, just like morals, if we don't like something, try to change it.
Yeah.
You know, one set of hands working is far, far more beneficial than 1,000 clasped in prayer. And I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, it's a famous saying. But the idea is that, you know, 1,000 people with hands clasped in prayer do nothing. One set of hands doing something practical can really work. And, of course, the Christians will say
that we're doing something. Yeah, it's possible you might feel better from praying, but what good does that do you if the problem is still there?
It's still the placebo effect. And the fact is I think that if they did a day's worth of actually something beneficial and realistic, they'd feel far better.
I mean, it's kind of extreme, but, like, you could stand in the middle of a street and pray that the oncoming traffic is not really there and can't hit you, but let's face it, chances are good you're going to get clipped by somebody.
And if they don't, they'll say that, you know, God made these people swerve out of the way and hit the wall, crashing and burning people screaming.
Right.
You know,
it couldn't possibly have anything to do with the fact that drivers don't want to hit a living person. No, God did it. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things out there that work without the assistance of a deity that gets attributed to a deity all the time. I remember there was, I hate to call it a legend, there was a recorded event or something where Napoleon had asked his map makers to make a map of the world. And so this one cartographer makes this map. You know, Napoleon looks at it and says, hey, this is actually really good, but I noticed that there's no room for God here. He's not included anywhere. And the map maker looks at Napoleon and says, it works without that assumption, my lord. And it's like, well, yeah, of course it does. I mean, we don't need God to make a lot of these things work, but the religious like to plug him in there anyway, I guess because they need to.
I think it makes most people uncomfortable, the idea that morals are a personal judgment call. They'd much prefer to take the lazy route and not put it on the onus on themselves that they made the decision to do something wrong. They'd much rather have it set up like the stone monolith in 2001, A Space Odyssey, something permanent, fixed in time and space. And the unfortunate part is, as we've discussed over and over again, is about the idea, the difference between something that's objective and something that's subjective. And it's overcomplicated by people. And as you've pointed out, a lot of people put it almost like an intensity on a volume control where, to 10...
People like to think of subjective as kind of, sort of, and objective as really, really. But that's not what the words mean at all.
No.
I mean, if you want to be as simple as possible, objective is an object. It's about something that's external to you, that doesn't depend on your mind for its state of being, for its configuration, for anything really about it. Whereas subjective is something that a subject, a person, will think. It's something that goes through your head. It's not necessarily opinion. It could just be imagination. But the fact is that subjective things are, generally speaking, thoughts or feelings or opinions or notions. They're not, they have no corporeal existence. They have no reality outside of your personal perspective. That's what subjective means, is perspective.
And as science gets better and better, we realize that there's rarely anything in the universe that actually is tied to the object in a finite, permanent way. For example, even the speed of light is subjective. And time itself is subjective, as Albert Einstein pointed out, that to the observer, it depends on whether you're on the ship traveling near the speed of light or the person who's sitting on Earth watching them through a telescope, each person is going to have a subjective observation of time. And it's everything, and that includes morality. Morality, especially because it's an ethereal, made-up thing. The universe has no morality, and that's something that I've battled with and bashed my head against the desk over and over again. There are many people on YouTube making books and people in philosophy and theology who believe that the universe is either good or bad, that the world is either good or bad, that people are either good or bad. That's a judgment call. That's your subjective viewpoint on this part of the universe.
Yeah, people have made those arguments at me many, many times. And I've tried to explain to them that for morality to be objective rather than subjective, they have to be able to identify its source that does not come from a mind, human or otherwise. And most of the religious like to say, well, God made it up, therefore it's objective and not subjective. Well, I'm sorry, but if God came up with it, God has a mind. God is a personality. And therefore, any rules that God has come up with are subjective, not objective. They don't want to hear that. They don't want to believe that. They don't like that at all. They want the legitimacy that they think objectivity lends. Because when something is objective, it's not subject to minds, perspective, or opinions. And so they want objective morality so that people can't dispute it, so that it can't be a matter of perspective. It can't be, well, I feel this way, well, I feel that way. How do we tell who's right? We don't know. They don't want any of that. They don't want the ambiguity. And I can understand that, but it may just be tough.
And it doesn't matter how many people, it's not represented by the number of people who believe something to be right or wrong, whether or not it's subjective. It's still subjective. One good example I would think of is that a nice young man, his name is Nick, he goes by the name Nicotine2 on YouTube, NYKYTYNE2. What he's a philosophy student, And what he has determined for himself is he said he believes there's an objective morality because things like, say, female circumcision, he said the majority of people think it's abhorrent, objectionable, and really, really bad. Therefore, he feels that it's at least close to or objective. It's not, because there are still people. There are people in the outback of Africa, there are people in the desert there who believe very strongly that not only is it a good thing to have a female circumcised, but it is the law. It is important, and you will definitely be punished if you don't.
And the thing is that no matter how much I disagree, no matter how strongly I disagree, no matter if I could get everyone else on the planet to agree with me that female circumcision is bad, and it is, but even if every thinking being in the entire universe agreed that it's bad, that still would not make it objective. To be objective, it cannot be a matter of opinion, a matter of perspective. It can't be human doctrine or dogma. It can't be law. The only way it can be objective is if it has nothing to do with a mind anywhere ever, any mind at all. And that's why I like to use the shorthand of pointing out that anything that's objective tends to be physical, tends to be a substance, something science can address, whereas something that's subjective is thoughts, opinions, feelings, preferences, that kind of thing. But people don't want to hear that, though. They see subjective as kinda sorta and objective as really, really. So they try to claim that things they care about a lot are objective so that they come off as more important, so that people take them more seriously. Absolutely. And it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, there are certain things that can be at least on a non-quantum scale, be quantified, and that would be where you'd get the objective. How big, how small? Big, small, hot, cold, larger than, smaller than. Those things can at least, to the average observer on planet Earth, be quantified. They can be put down, but we've all seen too. We've heard of Schrodinger, who definitely had. I was saying with Schrodinger, he said the observer alters whatever he's looking at too. I mean, it works the same with morality too. You alter the morality by observing something. You are putting your own judgment on it, and regardless, or even if it's written down in a book, still works the same way. In that, once you've observed it, you've given it a judgment call, and it also has to do with not only what you've got written down in your book, but it also has to do with your own personal little mores. And the easiest way to tell is how people filter and cherry pick out of the Bible their idea of morals. Over the last few years, the Bible, all the things that people consider moral right things to take out of the Bible have become less and less. For example, like stoning a child to death for talking back to his parents. That used to be something that had to be done. It was a moral prerogative. Now it's, well, that was then, this is now. But something in the book of Leviticus, for example, Leviticus, it says, a man shall not lay down with a man as he would with a woman. They love that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure part of that is that they need an enemy. Religion is not happy, or at least the Christian religion is not happy, unless they have someone where they can point to them and say, these are against us. These are the people that we have to attack because they're not like us. Rally around us, people, to get them. I mean, that's a large part of where the whole hatred of homosexuality comes from religiously. I mean, there have been religions that declared black people or various other slave races as inferior inherently. People used to follow that too, but now that's fallen out of vogue. They're going after the gays. These days, actually, atheists tend to be hated more than gays. So there is that. At the same time, it's like these people, they pick and choose. They look at their scripture and they say, this is something that we agree with. This is something we don't. I mean, eating meat on Friday used to be a sin. Now it's not. What was it, purgatory or was it limbo? I can never remember. I think it was limbo. Used to exist and now it doesn't. And it's just like, okay, so were the people who believed in limbo just completely freaking wrong back in the day? Make up your minds.
Oh, and it's just a perfect point that morals change as people change. Because it is made by people. It's, you know, it's like a stamp for Made in the USA. It's made by people. You can see that stamp on every moral judgment. It basically comes down to, we, as you and I know, and most sensible free thinkers in my mind do, they know that this was made by Stone Age to Bronze Age people to try to explain the world around them and to make it a little safer and a little more comfortable for them. So a lot of morals were designed to say, oog, I don't like when I see a guy kissing another guy, and the other, his friend says, you know what, I don't either. Why don't we make a law? And that's where the moral comes from. And they just make it a moral judgment call so that they don't have to be argued with.
Well, it goes to the tagline of my YouTube videos. Don't run on automatic. Please think. That says, sort of offhandedly, but it still says that we have to improv, that the universe is not perfect, that we can't do one-size-fits-all morality. We can't do one-size-fits-all expectations. You have to stop and actually think once in a while instead of just running on automatic, instead of going on the rails. A lot of people do not want to do that. They find it abhorrent somehow. It's too much work or something. I don't know. But yeah, it's not good for us. It really isn't. And so if you have an objective morality, if you have a set of rules that you can just memorize and never have to think about again, well, you're doing it wrong, people.
Well, even they themselves subconsciously have been slowly diluting their own moral code to match the modern day. For example, in the days of Puritan Europe, from Cromwell's day, when they kicked, went away because they couldn't be barbaric to their own people underneath of English law. So they came to the United States. That's where your ancestors are, my friendly American cousins, the Puritans. They came, and at that time there was a biblical passage that they followed as a moral prerogative. It was, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. And that was right up until, there's many European countries that still to this day believe that. And Africa, there a lot of people bring the Christian religion in and have them. They burn women, smart women usually, or at least the women who are loners or don't decide to get married early, and they decide they're a witch, they will burn them to death because the Bible does say, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. One of many, many wonderful codes. But most people in the Western society say, you know what, that's barbaric. That's old time. We don't follow that anymore. So the moral has changed subtly, slowly over time. So even they, whether they're willing to admit it or not, their morals have changed drastically, even over the last 100 years.
Weirdly, though, in a strange sort of way, that is just a symptom rather than the disease. Because the real, true disease of religion is nonconformity. They don't like it if you don't fit in. And if you look at it, I mean, you've got homosexuals. Well, religion expects that you are heterosexual, that you will breed. It's the same thing with condoms. They expect that you will breed when you have sex and not have sex for any other reason. With both of those, with some of the other things we've got, there are some of those religions that have laws against transplants or whatever, medical transplants, that kind of thing, laws against races. You know, it all comes down to nonconformity. You are not like us. You are alien. You are the other. Even if we treat the symptoms, even if we go and say to religion, we're not going to tolerate your racism or your homophobia anymore, well, they'll just find some other way that non-believers are nonconformists and revile that aspect next. It really, what we have to do is find some way to get them to be tolerant of those who are not like them.
Oh, yes. And, of course, a lot of things, even when we remove religion from our lives, we've created our own new ones. Even a lot of atheists do that. We've seen that in the feminist group. They've made men who do not completely agree, and women, with their views, be the people who deviate from the norm, their norm. Even though a lot of people on the outside see that they look absolutely batshit crazy, forgive, there's not many other ways to put it, but they seem batshit crazy. To them, they see themselves as being in the moral high ground. They see that their morals are better than ours, that they see things in a way that we don't. And they are definitely believing that their morals are fixed in place, that they are objective, that there is no way around it, and they are definitely not going to give any wiggle room to any dissenting ideas.
Yeah, that's definitely, as far as I'm concerned, that's a steaming pant load. But what can you do? These people genuinely believe that. They believe not only that, but that this world was given to them by their deity, that it belongs to them, and that nonconformists are the enemy somehow, that we are the ones who will end up in hell, or when the rapture comes, we'll be left behind and have to choose to either be servants of God or Satan or whatever it is their legends say. It's really difficult to remember sometimes. It seems to change with the tides or with the religion that you're looking at specifically. Oh, yeah. That kind of thing. Some religions don't even seem to have that whole apocalyptic ending thing going on. But the point is that if you're not like them, then you are automatically suspect, even the enemy. And there is one group out there right now that is expecting conformists of all its members, even though they're trying, and I emphasize trying, to be subtle about it, and that would be the United States Army.
A place that definitely doesn't have casual Fridays.
Yeah. Well, they've started instituting a kind of mental fitness test with some fairly innocuous-seeming questions on it. But those questions, when you answer them the quote-unquote wrong way, you're suggested that you need to get religion to correct, quote-unquote correct, the problem. The U.S. military has always been a haven for religious types, but it's just plain getting worse now.
It has been building up, but it's been building up under a cover of secrecy. And thankfully, there's been people, chaplains and enlisted men and people who've left the military for one reason or another are finally beginning to talk. But the questionnaire has questions on it that seem, as you say, very innocuous. They seem rather benign, but what they have is things like, do you believe in a higher power? Do you believe in a personal savior? They ask questions that are very pointed to see, are you religious or not? Now, what happens is that supposedly it's not supposed to see your commanding officer. Now, as we know in the military, the CO of any military branch definitely knows all and is in control of all, no matter if you like it or not. But the chaplain or a counselor will come to you if you've done this and you have said, no, I don't believe in a personal God. I don't believe in a higher power. They'll say, we believe that your spiritual health may need work. So please, I'd like you to think about it. And their thinking, their explanation, their rationalization to people is that they believe that someone who is, in their words, spiritually healthy will have less likelihood of committing suicide. Which does not factor when you look at the statistics of people committing suicide. It is a far higher margin of people who believe in a God than for atheists.
Yeah, yeah. Now, to be fair, I did have one of my YouTube subscribers who is apparently a chaplain in one branch or another of the military actually sent me a private message and asked me, so how should I deal with the atheists in my unit? I'm supposed to counsel to them, but if they're not religious, what can I say? It's like this person knew how to deal with people from other religions because it was similar enough. You know, just get right with God. But how do you deal with an atheist? And the only legitimate, reasonable answer I could give was, I don't know. I mean, atheists don't conform. Not really. I mean, some of them do. Some of them are very similar. But there is no one way to be an atheist. We don't have doctrine or dogma or holy texts or anything like that. Whereas religion does. The religious holy texts can give you a pretty good idea of what you need to say to a religious person, and it can start to funnel their interests and behavior into a strict and narrow path. But it doesn't work like that with atheists, because atheists don't have that kind of stimulus. Again, I could not give a legitimate answer to this person, because there is no one way to counsel an atheist.
Absolutely. I mean, and you don't even want to give them ideas from renowned philosophers of history, because they're rather dark, gloomy, and self-destructive, to be totally honest. Someone like Jean-Paul Sartre or any of the others, it's not exactly the feel-good books that you can use to cheer up some atheist who is potentially having maybe a crisis of conscience. But one thing you can do is tell them that they have the answers within themselves all along, that they have to search themselves. I mean, that's a woo-woo that you can use with Christians, Buddhists, and with, you know, non-theists. But the idea is that we have the answer in us all along. Now, the Christian will just read that as meaning that God's in your heart, and that's what we need. I think that would be about the only recommendation you could safely give without offending an atheist.
Well, there are counterpoints to some of those darker philosophers, of course. I mean, if you read, the Four Horsemen, Dawkins, Dennett, Harris, and Hitchens, Dawkins in particular gives a lot of ways in which atheists can find a lot of joy in life. And in fact, it seems to me that atheists are uniquely suited to find joy in life. So many religious people are out there saying, well, I'm going to go to the afterlife. I'm going to go to heaven. Things are going to be great then. And all I have to do in this life is conform and behave and sacrifice and all of this stuff. But an atheist knows this is the only life we get, or at least is pretty darn sure of that. So we have to make the most of it. And therefore, we can actually find joy in this world much easier than a theist can, at least in theory, at least with some theists. I'm sure there's theologies out there that take joy in this world as well, but the more popular ones tend to look at this life as somehow transitory, as somehow being a test, where you're almost supposed to deprive yourself of things in order to get into heaven. To an atheist, that's just gotta be sick, because it means you're gonna miss out on your only chance. You've got to have fun.
Well, it works not only with Christianity, but Judaism believes that as well, as does things like Buddhism, which has used that to make slaves of their people for, you know, countless generations, that if you suffer in this life, it will guarantee you a reward in the next. It's also the same with even if you go back to, say, Viking or Norse tradition, they believe that if you're a good warrior, when you die in the field of battle, you will come back with the chance to get to a place that's absolutely fantastic. So, I mean, it works that way. And unfortunately with us, we know that when we die, it's worm food. So yes, we do want the things, the here and now. It doesn't always have to be a double rainbow or something like that. I'm sure that drugs would help for some people. But I think there's, everybody can find an anchor point in this world to make it a better place. For myself, my granddaughter, my friends, my best friend Kate here, of course, and the things around me, good meal, the smell of a flower. A lot of these things seem very glib and superficial, but frankly, that's what life is.
You know, as long as you're not hurting somebody else, grab for as much joy and fun as you possibly can, gang. Seriously. I mean, when are you going to get another chance?
I think a lot of, in ancient Egypt, even though a lot of the woo-woo that goes around it isn't all that great, they basically felt that the only way to gain immortality was for people to remember and speak your name. And I think that's the same with the atheist world, too. That if you can leave a little piece of yourself behind so that people remember you and pass yourself down from generation to generation, a little piece of you remains here on Earth. I mean, you're not going to be here to know it, but at least you can be content in this here and now with a smile on your face going, I've made a difference.
Although I think it was, I think it was Woody Allen who said, I don't want to achieve immortality through my works. I want to achieve immortality by not dying. And I'm kind of with them on that. I mean, if I could live forever or die trying, I'd totally go for it. But hey,
yes, we're still in the real world, sadly, but until they gain a lot more insight into the human anatomy and work out things like how to freeze you without having each and every one of your cells explode into a little puddle of goo, we're stuck with our 80 to 120 years of, hopefully, bliss.
In the meantime, I do intend to try and make a name for myself. If you're of a mind, you can go check out my webcomic, The Adventures of Kinnera Baxter, at kinnerabaxter.comicgenesis.com. It's kind of a Star Wars meets Star Trek kind of thing. And who knows, it could propel me to some certain amount of fame. Let's hope, right?
Well, you've already done some experiments with getting it into a hard copy variety, so I think people, if people, enough people are curious, you can definitely let Kate know at her Bionic Dance channel or from her Kinnera Baxter page that you would actually be interested in something tangible. I'm sure that can be arranged.
Indeed, indeed. So, if an atheist is going to enjoy this life or is going to make their mark, leave a legacy on the world, I mean, you know, that is certainly one way for us to, I don't know, to find, not exactly heaven, not exactly an afterlife, but at the very least, it means that we can enjoy our time here and share that with other people. And honestly, isn't that something that's very important, is to spread joy around?
Yeah, and die with a smile on your face would be preferable.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, and also, even if you don't have children of your own, if you can make other people smile and happy in this life so that when they get older, they don't turn into nasty, malicious bastards. We don't want an entire culture of these emos who walk around grumbling, looking down at the ground and thinking that life is shit. If you can make the difference in one person's life, even one where they walk around with a smile on their face and then they pass it on to their children or friends and so on, you've actually made sort of a pay it forward sort of contribution to society.
Which is actually a really great thing to do. Although there are some theists out there who think that atheists never have a good time, that atheists simply cannot be joyful without God, that they just don't understand how that can possibly be. It only makes them redouble their efforts to try to prove that God exists to us. Unfortunately, their methods of trying to prove that God exists are frankly terrible. Maybe they're convinced by this woo-woo, by this BS that says to them, yes, I felt a presence and it was wonderful and clearly it has to be God. Evidence? What do you mean evidence? I have no evidence. Although some people, like I'm thinking about Fox News' Bill O'Reilly here, have some of the worst evidence possible. Evidence that clearly doesn't need God to exist. You know what I'm talking about, don't you, Glenn?
Oh, I do. He's worth a few laughs if you take him with a grain of salt. But he is sort of the figurehead on the Fox News, and I use that term loosely, the Fox News channel, that is definitely neither fair nor balanced. And his big saying right now, and he's done this often, he's done this multiple times, where what he'll do is if someone says, I don't believe in God, he'll say, how can you not? The tides come in, the tides go out without any change. How can you say that there is no God? And I say, back to grade 7.
That's why a grain of salt is perfect for this analogy, because he's talking about the freaking tides here. He's talking about the ocean going in and out. Well, gang, the ocean tides go in and out because of the gravitational pull of the moon. And anybody could have told him that, but for some reason, Bill O'Reilly, he never got that memo somehow. Yep. And he seems to think that unanswerable questions give us the opportunity to plug God into the gaps. It's that whole God of the gaps argument.
Yep.
And it just plain doesn't work that way. Why are humans, even some atheists, but why are most humans just so allergic to saying, gosh, I don't know, let's find out. Let's do some research and investigation. No, they want easy answers. They want this God to exist, to do all the stuff they don't understand, rather than live with uncertainty. And honestly, I cannot empathize with that. While I may not want to live with uncertainty, it means I'm going to work to find out. It doesn't mean I'm going to make crap up that just feels right and go with that.
And that's what they argue with science is not the right way. They always use that science doesn't know everything. And I'll tell them, of course, well, neither do you. And they'll say, no, anytime I don't know, it's God. And that's, it's cyclical thinking, for example, like saying, how do you know there's a God? The Bible tells me so. How do you know that that's right? Because God says the Bible's right. And where did God say that? The Bible. It's round and round we go until you're completely dizzy. And there's definitely, they want the mystery. I mean, in the Catholic Church, they call much of what's going on with Jesus going up to heaven, Jesus making loaves of bread and fish and things, they call it the mysteries. They call all these things the mysteries. How did he come back from the dead? The mysteries. All these things, they want it to be mysterious. And if it isn't mysterious, somehow you've done something sinful. If you've unveiled, it's like the wizard in the Wizard of Oz. It's like pulling back the curtain. You've done a horrific thing. You've shamed yourself. You've shamed your God. Terrible, terrible stuff.
Yeah, and you know, honestly, I'd rather know than not know. These people don't seem to operate that way. They'd rather feel rather than know. I mean, you want a balance of both of those things. You want to be able to feel and to know.
Sure.
But at the same time, if I had to pick one or the other, I'd rather have knowledge than feelings. I mean, not to say I want to turn into a freaking Vulcan over here.
No.
But, you know, I want as many correct answers and as few false answers as possible. And just because something feels right doesn't mean that it is. And it doesn't mean I should act like it is. If I said, hey, the traffic will swerve, they'll avoid me and there will be no damage done, not to me, not to them. Well, that sounds great on paper, but try it.
And I think the Christians are getting the Muslims as well, and many other religions, they are increasingly upset as the decades go by, because every time they used to have things like, how can you explain how the sun works? And we would say, we don't exactly know, but we will someday. And they go, ha ha, God did it. And now we can say, you know, the fusion inside of the hydrogen and the helium, and it creates heavier elements, and it increases, and there's a fusion reaction at this particular. We could tell you how many billions of electron volts it takes to do it. And we can be right down to the last particle, very accurate. And they go, okay, how about magnetism? As we know with the insane clown posse. Just, you know, good listening all the way around, you juggalos out there. I'm just saying that so you don't key my car or, you know, blow me up or something. But, you know, magnets, how do they work? Ooh, mysterious.
I don't even get me started on the BS surrounding evolution. And the whole transitional species thing, the number of times where we found one species and we found another species is very, very similar, very genetically, very physiologically, very, very structurally similar. We can show how various traits they have in common and how far back one is versus the other. And we can clearly show, demonstrate that the one became the other. And they're like, yeah, but there's this big old gap here in the middle. And it's like, it doesn't matter how many levels of gradation we find between those two species, they'll still go, yeah, but there's a gap here. And so many of them seem to think that evolution happens where, like, a crocodile lays an egg and you get a duck out of it or something like that. Pretty clear that they don't want it to be true, that they don't value knowledge. They don't value figuring things out. They have more of a need to feel right than to be right. If something challenges them, if it's counterintuitive or if it contradicts their God or their scripture or whatever, they will reject it rather than bowing to the facts. Right. I mean, the sheer number of times I've wished that UFOs were real. Well, I've never actually seen one. I've never actually been abducted by an alien. I've never seen an extraterrestrial. So by what right do I have to say that they're real just because I want them to be? Now, replace extraterrestrial with God. If you've never seen God, how do you know the fucker's real? I ask you.
I can empathize with their point is that, you know, when you've been doing something since the age of probably 3 or 4, like getting down on your knees and praying to this invisible sky daddy, and you've been guaranteed that by doing so, you get a life of bliss on the other side of death, you can empathize that that's something you don't want to let go of. We all would love sure. something that's unreal to happen. How many kids would love to open up their wardrobe and find Narnia?
Yeah.
But we don't.
Believe
we don't,
me, I'd love it. I'd absolutely love that kind of thing. Yeah. But at the same time, I'm not going to assert that it's true just because I want it to be desperately.
Yeah.
I seem to remember Richard Dawkins likes to tell this one story about a friend of his, a colleague, who had this hypothesis, this scientific idea in his head for years, decades even. I think it was like 20 years, 16 years, something like that. And then one day, a student or a youngster, some guy that was like not nearly as senior as Richard Dawkins' friend, manages to definitively disprove this guy's hypothesis. The guy thanked the kid, said, "Thank you. I've been wrong all this time, and now I'm right. And you've shown me how to be right. Thank you for that." Now, that is humility, and that's difficult for a lot of people. But that is the ideal, especially in science. If I am wrong, I do want to know it, even though it may shame me, even though it may be difficult to take.
It shows dignity and it shows intelligence. We've seen, even when you take out religion altogether, people, it's a nature of the beast. It obviously is. For example, what's happening now with the anti-vaccination group. They've now unequivocally proven that the scientist who was in charge of this was being paid under the table by a company that was making an alternative to the mercury-based preservative that was in vaccines, and they gave him the job of completely discrediting all vaccines that were available to date. Now, he did this very well. He went to people like Jenny McCarthy, famed ex-porn star and movie star, wife of Jim Carrey, and she has an autistic child, and they had her as the spokesperson for this movement. Now, he was found out to be a shill, in the purest sense of the word, and he also did cruel and unusual test subject testings on children with spinal taps that he didn't need, definitely fudged the works. He was definitely a fraud and a shyster, definitely not worthy of the term doctor. Now, even though they take him away, the people who are still believing in this anti-vax say that he was right, that he just maybe made some mistakes and people are turning him into some sort of Christ for them, that they're crucifying him in order to try to keep something that's hurting people on the market. They are completely convinced and they will not be convinced of any contradictory evidence, no matter how strong it is. And we have the papers. He's even, you know, had to prove, say he's guilty in a court of law. He won't say that in public, but the fact is that it's been proven as close as you can to 100%. People still want to believe that vaccines cause autism.
Well, it's like Peter Popoff. People want to believe that he's completely psychic, no matter how many microphones they find in his ear.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was proven on national television to an audience of 100 million people back in, what was this, the late 70s, early 80s. The Amazing Randy made it possible with a police scanner. And all they did is go into the Peter Popoff Ministries. We spoke about this a couple of podcasts ago. But the fact was is that he would get people to fill in the form when they came in the door about what their ailment is. And then he would, of course, walk through the audience. His wife would point him in the right direction. And voila, he had the person.
Yeah, it's just people desperately want to believe and are very afraid of being shown wrong because, well, I think what it is really is that humanity does not like to be humble, does not like the sort of the shame and embarrassment of going, oops, my bad. And I can understand that. I don't like it much either. But there are times when I'm forced to do it simply because the facts are not on my side. I'm very unlikely to do it when it comes to something that's purely opinion, purely a matter of taste. Usually I stick to my guns there. Yeah. But if you can give me actual empirical, objective facts, well, I'll admit that I'm wrong. Maybe not happily, but I'll do it because I'll be forced to.
Sure. And it is definitely human nature. I mean, I remember a story that someone has told me not that long ago. Amazing Randy, somebody actually went up to him and said, you're a shyster, you actually use real magic. They were convinced that they were so convinced in magic that his debunking of magic by using sleight of hand, which is what it is, was actually magic in and of itself, that he was trying to fool people.
Right, which is just, it's such a weird, twisted mirror universe version of what we usually expect to see happen. I mean, usually people are denounced as fakes, not denounced as genuine supernatural magicians. I don't know if we've done this in a podcast or not, but at some point I'd really love to discuss the difference between natural and supernatural on one of our podcasts. Make a note of that.
I will. And I think we've skirted it, we've come around it, but I mean, it's one of the many subjects that has much, much material. I mean, there are people who their entire life, all they talk about is debunking these things, including the Amazing Randy. James Randi is just, you know, every day that he remains alive on this planet is, I think, in my own opinion, a better day.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. He's definitely one of the more brilliant men out there, definitely one of the better debunkers of, well, let's face it, bunk that needs to be debunked, that needs to be exposed as the frauds that they are. That's James Randi. He's an awesome, awesome fellow. And recently came out as gay, which is only too awesome.
I can definitely see where that would be an extra shining star on the top of his tree with yourself. And I have a great deal of respect for him. And regardless of his sexual orientation, it doesn't matter. That does not make him any more or less of a wonderful human being. And I feel very bad for him that he has felt the need up to this point to keep it so concealed as he has.
And I'm sure a lot of that was actually a need to maintain his credibility with his audience. Because let's face it, if people want to dismiss somebody, they'll find any excuse. Right. You know, even if James Randi were completely 100% factually right about something, they'd probably go, yeah, but are you going to believe a fag? You know, that's just the way people are. Anything to dismiss somebody. You know, I mean, if someone makes a statement that you think you can ridicule, even if the statement is correct, even if the statement is factually correct, well, people will take that opportunity. It's just, humans do not like to be proved wrong, and humans are much, much more cynical than I think most people give them credit for.
Well, yeah. And I don't think it's that being proven wrong. I think they want their fantasy world to be correct is the big thing. Is they don't mind with you put this on your form instead of that. They go, okay, my bad. But if they have a fantasy world in their minds, something of their imagination that they want to be real, we've seen it. There was a documentary called Trekkers a few years ago with Denise Crosby of Star Trek The Next Generation, in which she actually interviewed many people who were diehard Star Trek fans. They create a universe in their real life that is so real to them, they are in the 24th century in their mind. There was a woman who was actually brought up for jury duty, and she refused to stop wearing her captain's uniform when told to do so by the judge to enter into jury duty. She said, I am a Starfleet captain, and therefore I will not remove my uniform. In her fantasy world, this was all as real as the street light, as a microphone, as a police car. It all was very, very real and tangible in her mind.
Well, and I think that's a large difference between myself and a lot of other sci-fi fans, at the very least, and the difference between me and a lot of other religious people is, as much as I want it to be true, and I do, I have a Star Wars tattoo. I have the Rebel Alliance insignia tattooed on my left arm. I want it to be true desperately. However, I have to bow to the reality that it is not. I have to bow to the fact that it is fiction. Really wonderful fiction as far as I'm concerned, but what can you do? Should I live my entire life based on a lie? No. If I'm ever going to go to space and live like Luke, Han, and Leia, I want it to be real, damn it. I want that spaceship to actually take me somewhere, not just in my head. Mind you, that won't stop me from playing a video game, but you get the idea.
Yeah, and it's not like you'd actually, you know, own a lightsaber or go out in public in a stormtrooper outfit or someone from the Rebel Alliance or anything like that. That would be just plain insanity, wouldn't it?
Well, not unless it's like Halloween or something.
Or something.
Yeah. I have found excuses to do that sort of thing. I mean, here in Seattle, we have this thing called the Fremont Solstice Parade that is traditionally crashed by several hundred naked, body-painted people on bicycles. I don't have a bicycle, so I use my rollerblades. And I was painted up as a Rebel Alliance X-Wing pilot. That was this last summer. So, yeah. Oh, and there's footage of that on YouTube if you want to go looking for it. Trust me. But my point is that as much fun as that was, I can still draw that dividing line between fact and fantasy. It seems like religious people can't, or at least won't.
That's true. And it's no different between someone who has created a life around Star Trek or someone who's created life around the Episcopalians.
Well, I don't know a whole lot about the Episcopalians. I have to admit, it's not specific dogma that bothers me about religion so much as it is faith. In particular, the belief without proof part of religion.
The blind faith.
As soon as somebody can prove to me that a God is real and that this God expects X, Y, or Z of us, that's when I'll start paying attention to specific dogma.
Yeah, and let's make the discrimination in between. I mean, we've discussed this before, but you believe in faith in that somebody from their past experience with you to now, you have faith in them. You have belief that they will do the same thing, even though a lot of people say that is too trusting and things like that. But generally speaking, if you have a friend, you can have faith in that friend because you do have some kind of past experience. You may even sometimes fool yourself into thinking that a person who gets drunk every time you give them $20, that if you give them $20, you have faith that they're not going to do it again. But it's very different from the blind faith that says that God's telling you to do this, don't ask why, just do it.
Well, once again, I mean, it does come down to evidence. If I have faith in my friends that they will behave in certain ways, given certain stimuli, it's because I've seen them do it before. It's because I can make an informed judgment, an evidence-based judgment on what I expect of their behavior. I can make predictions based on facts, based on evidence. But when you have faith in God, where's your evidence? For most people, it's only in their heads. For most people, their only evidence is, I felt this way. I felt God's presence. Well, I mean, how do you know that you feeling God's presence doesn't feel exactly the same way as when I hear a song by my favorite band and it really moves me? How do you know that they aren't the exact same feelings? You don't. I don't either. But the fact remains is I'm much more likely to come to that conclusion than I would yours, unless a God actually showed up in some tangible, empirical, objective way, in some way that I could check. I mean, if I could poke God in the nose with my finger and say, yep, that seems real to me, then maybe we're in business. But so long as your God only speaks to you in your heart, there's a very real chance you're delusional or at least thinking wishfully.
And actually, as a segue, something that I have heard in the last 24 hours was that they've now done test studies in the lab using MRIs, that's using magnetic resonance imaging in the lab where they have a person inhale a radioactive substance and then look at their brain. They've actually now done studies of people with music as part of this connection, where someone's favorite music that gives them the goosebumps, they've actually had them sit down and listen to that music. They found the same chemicals in the brain that are the same as having an orgasm, having a faith experience, for example, like you believe that you've heard God, that you've fallen in love. The oxytocin, the serotonin, all the chemicals in the brain that would be there when you fall in love or have an earth-shattering experience of any other kind are there.
So it's possible that God is in fact real. He just happens to be chemicals you yourself generate. I kind of like that, actually. It makes perfect sense. I mean, granted, I have to be wary, and let's just put the whole evidence-based argument out there once more, is as much as I want that to be the case, because it fits with my personal prejudices, my personal biases, my expectations, that the feeling of a deity is a chemical reaction that has nothing to do with a supernatural being. As much as I want that to be true, I cannot take it for granted, and should not, and frankly, will not. It's very important that we take this with a grain of salt and make sure that it's true.
And it all comes down to, folks, is that we can never prove a negative, because you'd have to see the entire universe in its entirety as a snapshot, be able to look under every rock on every place. And the fact is that you have to be able to assert a positive. You can get 99.9% accurate, though.
Well, it is funny just how many religious people out there will say, have you examined the entire universe? And you have to answer no. And they say, how much do you think you've examined? And you'd have to say, like, you know, not even 0.1%. I've just seen Earth, and not even all of that. And they'll say, so how do you know that God isn't hiding out there in Alpha Centauri? The only answer I can give is, well, if he was, how could we possibly have any freaking knowledge of the guy? Yeah. They never have an answer for that one.
A better question is, why is he hiding?
Well, there is that, too. Yeah. So, what I mean, is he hiding from? It's just... These God of the Gaps arguments, these how do you know arguments, I mean, they don't work in the favor of religion. They really don't. No. If anyone ever wrote a holy book, if anyone was ever inspired by a deity, well, darn it, we should have evidence of that deity. We should have that deity's presence. They should show the heck up once in a while in an unambiguous way.
Well, logic would dictate, wouldn't it?
It would.
But unfortunately, they're not using logic, so it's going to have to be carried on, unfortunately, for another day. We have not solved the problem, but we have definitely discussed it thoroughly and in detail, and there'll definitely be more to follow. And I think
indeed. Unfortunately, it does seem as though we've discussed as much as we possibly can for this podcast, but yes. We'll get you for the next one.
Oh, absolutely. And so in closing, from myself, Glenn Watson, my YouTube presence is All Babies Are Atheists. You can find me at http://youtube.com/allbabiesareatheists.
And I am Kate Farr, your other evil atheist co-host, and you can find my YouTube presence under Bionic Dance, all one word. Just replace All Babies Are Atheists with Bionic Dance, and you can get me from the same URL. Also, once again, if you're of a mind, you can read my webcomic, The Adventures of Kinnera Baxter, at kinnerabaxter.comicgenesis.com. And it's kind of on hiatus right now, thanks to a hard drive crash, but there is over like 300 pages for you to read. There's a year and a half's worth of work, and it will be back soon. So give it a good read, check it out, have fun.
Absolutely. And of course, people, if you didn't get it from here, definitely go to theaword.podomatic.com, become a friend and a subscriber, and you'll know about upcoming events.
So, indeed. And remember, gang, don't run on automatic. Instead, please think.
And definitely stay safe, stay sharp.